It's Central Time. I'm Rob Farah. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. Coming up, climate change is having an impact on Wisconsin's cranberry farmers. A crop scientist tells us how growers can adapt. First, the U.S. voted last night to recommend criminal contempt charges against former Trump White House Chief of Staff Mark Meadows. That's after Meadows reversed on an agreement to cooperate with the House committee investigating the January 6th insurrection. Before the reversal, Meadows had turned over records to the committee, including text messages he exchanged with conservative figures on the day of the Capitol attacks. The committee released some of those messages to the public this week, and now some are saying the messages show a disparity between how Trump allies have talked about the riots privately versus in public. It's the week in Washington. We'll talk about that story and more, and you can join in at 800-642-1234. Should Trump allies and former staff members be cooperating with this investigation, or do you agree that they shouldn't testify? What do you make of how Trump allies were talking about January 6th in private versus what they said in public? What do you want to see happen to the people who helped plan the January 6th insurrection? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also email ideas@WPR.org. Amanda Turkle is the Washington Bureau Chief for HuffPost. Amanda, welcome back.
Thanks for having me.
Can you talk us through how this vote shook out last night?
Sure. Well, not surprisingly, it broke down basically along party lines. Democrats voted to hold Mark Meadows in contempt, and Republicans voted against it, except for two Republicans, Liz Cheney and Adam Kinzinger, who are both, they've both been Trump critics. And they serve on the January 6th committee investigating all this. So it's not surprising that they align themselves with Democrats.
And what's the significance of a former White House chief of staff being recommended for criminal contempt charges? We've also seen some other figures, including Steve Bannon, referred. But this is a highly placed official, or was, in the Trump administration.
Right. And I think for some people, you know, Bannon seems honestly an obvious case. He wasn't working in the White House at the time. His claims to executive privilege are sort of baffling. Again, he didn't work in government. Mark Meadows is, I think, a slightly more complicated case. He was White House chief of staff. He, you know, arguably has some claim to executive privilege. But I think what I think what the committee is saying is that he, you know, had already been cooperating. He said he would cooperate. He was handing over documents, including text messages and emails. He has written a book where he obviously tells quite a bit about, what he was doing in the White House, but he refuses to sit down for an interview. And so that is why Congress decided to hold him in contempt, because he basically, they're saying, stopped cooperating. Is all of this subject to executive privilege when he's already handed over so much and he's been writing this book? I think that Congress, you know, the Democratic Party and these Republicans determined that, you know, he doesn't have a case. And now it's up to the Justice Department about whether they want to pursue the contempt referral.
Talking to Amanda Turkle from HuffPost, Washington Bureau Chief there, looking at some of the top stories in national politics, including this vote yesterday to refer Mark Meadows, former Trump Chief of Staff, for charges of contempt. That goes to the Justice Department now. I want to listen to some of the text messages Meadows turned over to the committee. Republican Representative Liz Cheney shared some of the ones that Meadows received on January 6th. Here's one a Fox News host Laura Ingraham sent to Meadows on January 6th.
Quote, Mark, the president needs to tell people in the Capitol to go home. This is hurting all of us. He is destroying his legacy, Laura Ingraham wrote.
Can you talk about that and some of the other messages that Representative Cheney shared as part of last night's proceedings?
Yeah, so this was one of the most striking things, was to hear all of these Fox News personalities trying to get Mark Meadows to tell Trump to stop the riot at the Capitol. And that seems to be some indication that they know that these people are Trump supporters and he has the power to stop it because they'll listen to him. And what's jarring about this is because it's so different than everything else we've been hearing on Fox News about how January 6th was a false flag attempt, about how these people were patriots. You know, this has nothing to do with Trump. Privately, clearly, we now know that these same Fox News hosts were contacting the White House and telling Trump, this is bad. You need to tell your people to cut it out. So again, it just goes against everything that they've been doing publicly and that they have irresponsibly been trying to fan the flames that this was no big deal when privately, you know, we saw that day that they were freaking out.
I want to give a listen now to Laura Ingraham responding on her show yesterday. Here is a listen.
Both publicly and privately, I said what I believe, that the breach of the Capitol on January 6th was a terrible thing. Crimes were committed. Some people were unfairly hounded and persecuted and prosecuted, but it was not an insurrection.
Some people have pointed to Art Ingraham pointing the fingers at Antifa on the evening of January 6th over the insurrection, though. What is the talk about the discrepancy you were mentioning, Amanda, between those private messages to Meadows and what came out in the media?
Yeah, I mean, you know, on January 6th, she said people who can only be there, it was perpetrated by people who can only be described as antithetical to the MAGA movement. Now, they were likely not all Trump supporters, and like you said, the Antifa stuff. Sean Hannity said at the top of his January 6th show, I don't care. I don't know who they are. They're not people I would support. So, you know, sure, they're not saying like it's great to storm the Capitol, but they're also trying very, very, they never pinned the blame publicly on Trump. They never said that he should have stopped it sooner than he did. They didn't condemn the fact that he never really, you know, that his tweets didn't go very far. And if anything, sort of, you know, sort of seemed to condone what these people were doing. When again, privately, they were telling Trump, this is really bad. You need to make a statement and stop it. Again, privately, conceding that he had some responsibility here.
Let's go to our callers now at 800-642-1234. Brad is with us in Pleasant Prairie. Brad, hi.
Hi. I think if anybody knows anything about Donald Trump, he rules his domain with an iron fist. And I cannot for a second believe that all of these underlings did something without his express approval and support. The way he runs his business, it may be sloppy. He may not make money, but in some cases, but he is the absolute king.
Brad, thanks for the call. And that reminds me, Representative Cheney had also said at the hearings yesterday, Mr. Meadows' testimony will bear on another key question before this committee. Did Donald Trump, through action or inaction, corruptly seek to obstruct or impede Congress's official proceeding to count electoral votes? End quote. Is there a sense, as Brad was saying and as Representative Cheney was saying, that there's still efforts to look at former President Trump's responsibility for the events on January 6th?
Yeah, no, definitely. And I think, you know, a lot of this goes to the point Brad was making was, you know, all of this stuff that Meadows is doing, for example, and cooperating, not cooperating, how much is he talking to Trump about this? How much does he have Trump's, you know, backing to stop cooperating? You know, same with Steve Bannon, same with these other officials. You know, how much is Trump pulling the strings and how nervous are they about running afoul of him? And that's sort of the same issue that continues to come up as we see some of these documents. We saw that there was something from Mark Meadows saying that the military will be on standby to protect pro-Trump people, referring to January 6th. Now, there's not a lot of context around that. We don't know who he was talking to. We don't know exactly what it was about. But was that something Meadows was just saying? Was that something that came directly from the president? I think that's what people are looking at a lot on the committee is how much was Trump directly behind this?
Thanks for that call. Go to Jim now in Dubuque. Jim, hi.
Hi. Two issues. I wonder what your guest thinks of Representative Schiff presenting false information and showing some of the emails. He added things that weren't there in the original, and he left out a couple of paragraphs of continuation on one of the emails that put it in a better context. And I'm also wondering why they're resisting allowing this subpoenas to be evaluated by the judicial system and the court when it may be that the whole procedure is illegitimate because they did not follow their own rules and allowed Nancy Pelosi to select the Republican representatives that they wanted.
Jim, thanks for the call. First of all, he's saying Representative Schiff had added or deleted information in some of the emails?
I'm not familiar what he's talking about there, but I'm happy to address the next part.
Sure.
So, you know, the Pelosi ended up choosing the Republicans because she tried to go forward with a bipartisan committee modeled after the 9/11 commission, which was also a bipartisan effort. And I believe the way it worked was that because Democrats are in the majority, they would have picked the chair and the Republicans would have picked the vice chair. They came up with legislation that was had the backing of some Republicans, and a Republican actually helped write the legislation, but then Republicans rejected it. And so Pelosi felt that she needed to go forward with some sort of commission to examine January 6th. So it ended up being a very partisan one because Republicans wouldn't support the bipartisan one, which again, members of their own party had worked on. And in terms of going to court, I mean, you know, Steve Bannon, he's been charged with two counts of criminal contempt of Congress. He's scheduled to stand trial on July 18th. The Justice Department will decide now whether they go forward with anything against Meadows or not. And then he will also face the judicial system. So, you know, these individuals are actually facing the justice system and they are going to trial if the Justice Department decides to pursue charges against them.
Thanks for that call. We're talking to Amanda Turkle from HuffPost with us today for a weekly roundup of the top stories in Washington. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Should Congress be in session on the anniversary of the January 6th insurrection? There's talk in Congress on whether they should be there or not, symbolically or for a normal business day. Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. We'll pick up the conversation coming up on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We're picking up our look at some of the top stories in national politics. Amanda Turkle stays with us from HuffPost. Back to your calls at 800-642-1234 on the January 6th committee and the Mark Meadows referral for prosecution for not responding to the subpoena. Lisa is with us in Madison. Lisa, hi.
Hi. I'm just calling in regard to Mark Meadows and the fact that not only was he using his personal phone, but he was sending texts via an app that only the users could unlock the text, the message, and that none of this had been sent to the National Archives. And that's also when Mark Meadows decided to stop cooperating when the requests were made for those. And the other interesting feature is so many people have wondered why Trump didn't send help for that 187 minutes. And based on text he sent the night before and that length of period of time, it almost seems that he was hoping counter protesters could show up. And that would give him the ability in any ensuing violence to declare martial law.
Lisa, thanks for that call. First of all, Amanda, I think she's referring to the Signal app that Mark Meadows was using. And one of the texts sent to him and revealed by the Congressional Committee said something, 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 then check your Signal, apparently, for further communication.
Yes, right. That's what they, well, government officials and other government officials use it specifically to avoid open records requests. I mean, you know, Trump, what we're seeing come out of these documents is that, you know, it seems the fact that, you know, some officials try to say we didn't know what was going to happen, you know, this violence was appalling. It seems like they were well aware that there could be something like this. There was the former defense secretary who said in a January 3rd conversation with Trump that Trump has told him basically to do whatever was necessary to protect the demonstrators that were, you know, coming to Washington and coming to the Capitol. You know, Trump seemed aware that there was perhaps going to be some violence and something, and he wanted to use the military. He or his administration wanted to use the military to back them up, which, you know, we've seen him use the military in the past to clear out, you know, Lafayette Park right in front of the White House so he could walk across and do the photo op with the Bible. And so, you know, it's not surprising that he brought it up again.
Thanks for your calls on that issue. I want to move on to some other stories, including one, a related one you've been following, Amanda. What Congress is going to do on January 6th, 2022? What kind of things are members of Congress talking about?
So right now, the House is scheduled to be out of session, and the Senate is scheduled to be in session. And lawmakers we've talked to seem a little bit torn about the messages this sends. Senator Susan Collins said that she would not be in session. She said, "You never know when someone may decide to mark the anniversary. I just think that day is too freighted with anxiety and anger, and it would just be better if we did not have any sort of anniversary of that day." You know, we talked to other senators who say we absolutely should be here. I talked to Congresswoman Susan Wilde from Pennsylvania. She's a Democratic congresswoman. And I don't know if folks remember, but there was a picture of her lying on the ground looking like she was having a heart attack or a panic attack in the House gallery as the riot was underway. And she is part of this small group of lawmakers known as the gallery group, lawmakers who are stuck in there that day and they talk. And she said that she believes that they should be back to show that they weren't scared away. They're not afraid of coming back on January 6th. But there are other members who, you know, are quite traumatized by what happened even a year later and don't really want to be there. So there's a lot of talk about what will be done that day, if anything. And I think, honestly, some Republicans are a little nervous that Democrats will use that day to remind people what happened, which, you know, doesn't always reflect well on them and their defense of Trump.
Talking to Amanda Turkel from HuffPost, looking at a few of the top stories in the nation's capital this week. A check-in, Amanda, on the Build Back Better package. This is part two of the spending packages supported by the Biden administration. The infrastructure one is a done deal now. The other one, the social safety net, climate change, other stuff. Seems like the situation hasn't changed that much. Where are we right now?
Well, today was a pretty messy day in the Senate, actually, on this. You know, the Senate has imposed a Christmas deadline. Democrats wanted to pass this by Christmas. Honestly, right now, their big stumbling block is Joe Manchin. And today, he and Biden have been talking this week, and it doesn't seem like it's going all that well. There are now indications that Manchin, the Build Back Better legislation extends the child tax credit for 1 year. And the word was that this was a compromise because Senator Manchin wanted a work requirement attached. The rest of the Democrats said no. And so the compromise, okay, we'll just do it for one more year. But now Manchin is saying that he doesn't want the child tax credit in the legislation at all. There's some concern that he thinks this is a budget gimmick to lower the cost, which again, he is the one who has wanted the cost lowered. And so I think Democrats are really frustrated that they feel like Manchin is a bit of a bad faith negotiator and there's no pleasing him. You know, the goalposts keep changing. Supporters of Manchin are saying, no, he's been clear all along that he wants the cost lower, but he doesn't want it. He also thinks Democrats should basically be doing fewer programs for longer. So the indications we're getting is this is not going to be happening by Christmas. It's going to be pushed into the new year. And then, honestly, I don't know if Democrats will have the appetite to keep fighting over this. They're going to need to turn their attention to the midterms. This is pretty messy, and it doesn't really seem to help them a lot at the ballot. So progress right now is a bit stalled.
Is there any sign of maybe a last-ditch effort to get in by Christmas, or does it seem like Senate leadership is starting to set people up to say, no, it's not going to happen by then?
They are still, you know, they are still working on it and they're still trying. But, you know, we had Senator Ron Wyden today concede that it's, you know, on the Finance Committee conceding that it will probably be next year. And so I think some people are getting frustrated. I think people aren't very hopeful because, again, it's just, you know, what they could do is if they can't reach a deal with Manchin is just put it on the floor and say, look, we're going to do this by Christmas. We're calling your bluff. Are you really going to be the one to vote against this and knock down this bill, or are you going to actually support it? And so that's one option, and you know that seems to be the only way because it doesn't seem like they're close to a deal with him right now.
And just our last minute or so, Amanda, a story you've been following, blockage in the Senate for many Biden appointees. Movement on that. It looks like with a Wisconsin connection, Milwaukee Mayor Tom Barrett cleared a Senate committee in his appointments to an ambassadorship. What's been going on, though, with some blocked or at least delayed nominees?
Well, there have been some Republican senators, Ted Cruz, Josh Hawley, Tom Cotton, Rand Paul, to name a few, who have been in various ways blocking Biden nominees. And they're all doing this through regular rules. But, you know, the Biden administration is getting frustrated. They have had 38% of their nominees confirmed. That's compared to 50% at this time for Trump, 68% for Obama. And so, you know, they're getting pretty frustrated that a lot of these nominees are being held up for unrelated reasons, policy differences, for example, with the administration, rather than allowing these folks to get a fair up or down vote based on their merits.
Amanda, we'll leave it there. Thanks again for joining us today.
Thank you so much.
And talking to Amanda Turkel. She's the Washington bureau chief for HuffPost. She was with us today for our weekly look at the top stories in national politics. You can follow breaking news at WPR.org and over at NPR.org, where they also have their eyes on the latest news from Congress. Coming up after the news, we'll find out how cranberry crops are being affected by climate change and what Wisconsin's growers can do about it. Some advice from a crop expert on how to deal with those bogs in the midst of a changing climate. You can follow these and other conversations anytime online at WPR.org, where you can live stream the Ideas Network and go into our archives to check out past conversations. Also, you can download the Wisconsin Public Radio app, so you can do those exact same things on your phone. I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. Listening to Central Time, I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, one of Hollywood's newest movie directors joins us to talk about growing up in Wisconsin and how his debut film explores grief and loss through the story of a missing truffle pig. Now, Wisconsin is the most prolific producer of cranberries in the United States. In 2019, the USDA says the state's yield added up to almost 4.7 million barrels. But what does climate change mean for Wisconsin's official state fruit? Researchers are trying to find ways to adapt cranberry growth to changing temperatures. Amaya Atucha is an associate professor of horticulture with UW-Madison. She also serves as part of the UW Fruit Program as a fruit crop production specialist. She recently talked about her work with WPR host Lee Rayburn.
Amaya, let's begin with how important cranberries are to Wisconsin. How do cranberries contribute to Wisconsin's economy?
Well, cranberries are extremely important to Wisconsin. First of all, because cranberry is one of the very, very few fruit crops that are native to North America. And we have a lot of wild cranberries here in Wisconsin. So we have quite a bit of genetic diversity, which is basically, you know, finding like a mine gold in one sense, but also because Wisconsin is the top producer of cranberries in the world, and it contributes substantially to the economy of the state, whether it's through the fruit that it's, you know, sold, but also for job generation and also for agritourism. So many people come and want to see a cranberry marsh and want to look at their harvest. So it's not only important from an economic point of view for the state, but it also is an identity. It's our fruit crop for the state. It's our native fruit crop in North America, one of the most important. And so, yeah, it's very important.
So then give me some idea of how climate change is affecting our cranberry crops.
Well, climate change is affecting all of our crops. But one of the things that I think that in general people don't realize is that cranberries, very similar to other fruit crops, is a perennial crop. So these are plants that can live for many, many, many years, 25, 50 years, you can have a productive bed of cranberries. That's the kind of like the production unit. So when you have a perennial plant that has to survive many winters and many growing seasons, the effect of climate change is substantial because it accumulates over time. So some of the things that we see with climate change are, for example, these very extreme weather conditions, whether it's during the growing season with heat or during the winter with cold. And so when we have those swings of temperatures, the plants really have to adjust and find mechanisms to survive, whether it's freezing conditions or really high temperatures. And how do they do that? How do they adapt? Not all plants have evolved in that climate change situation, so they might not necessarily have the capacity to adapt. And that's why that's when we start to see some yield losses and some other problems that kind of arise. So extreme weather temperatures, extreme precipitations, things that we see during the growing season, during the spring or during harvest time, these downpours of rain really affect the quality of the fruit. It also, gets this microclimate around the vines and the fruit that increases a pathogen development. So that's another thing that we see. We see that with a little bit more of a warmer temperatures during the nights in the fall and the summer, that affects, for example, the development of color in the fruit. So that's another thing that we see with climate change. So there's many aspects of fruit production because this is a perennial crop that are affected due to climate change. When we think about climate change, many, many times we're reading the news things about, corn, soybean, or annual crops that they're only present during the growing season, during the spring, the summer, a little bit of the fall. But here when we're talking about cranberries, this is a perennial plant that lives many, many years and has to also survive the winter. So changes in the winter due to climate change substantially affects the production of cranberries.
Amaya Tuchar, our guest, she is an associate professor with the UW-Madison. And Amaya, as things stand, how sustainable will the growth of cranberry crops in Wisconsin be in the next, say, 10 years?
That's our job security as scientists. No? We're always trying to find solutions. How can we work this problem out? How can we find a solution? And so things that we do here at UW, I want to say I want to recognize there are many other scientists at UW-Madison working on cranberry. We have a really, really good relationship, strong relationship with the cranberry industry, and we work together to strategize and figure out what are our research priorities. How can we figure out solutions for things like climate change? So one of the things that my lab in particular works on is cold, and it's the perfect place because of Wisconsin, and cranberries are perfect because they are a perennial crop. And so we look at understanding how the plant adjusts to cold. What changes is the plant using to be able to withstand, these sub-zero temperatures that we sometimes have in January and February? And once we can discover what are the mechanisms that these plants are using, we can figure out ways of evaluating that. And that's where the diversity in genetic resources and wild plants comes into play. How can we find individuals that are more adapted to these changes in temperatures? Can we find individuals or genetic, differently genetic individuals that might have a more cold resistance, for example? Or if we're looking at other things like heat during the growing season, some plants that might be more adapted to higher temperatures. And once we find those individuals and we're able to evaluate them, we can integrate these traits through breeding, through traditional breeding. And that's where UW and the team of scientists that we have in UW, we all work together. Some of us works on maybe identifying some of those mechanisms, what others work on, how can we incorporate it into new cranberry cultivars that we want to release that will be able to withstand these changes in climate in the next 25 years.
So what have we learned so far through this research, through the team of researchers, through the grant of the USDA? What are we finding about cranberries in Wisconsin through cold weather and how they can survive?
Well, we've found some of the work that my lab has done and some of my graduate students, especially a PhD student that just graduated, Camille Villota, he did a lot of work looking at the mechanisms in which specific structures that contains the flowers during the winter survived freezing temperatures in the winter so that they can have flowers the following year and we can have fruit. And so with that mechanism, once we found out what's happening there, how the plants are able to adapt, we now are looking into testing a big germplasm that we have, that this is a collaboration with our colleague, Dr. Juan Salapa, who is a USDA IRS scientist, but is also a professor in the Department of Horticulture at UW-Madison. So we work together at trying to evaluate some of the germplasm. We also have another researcher working in the team, is Dr. Josh Namura, also a USDA IRS scientist, but also a professor here in the Department of Horticulture. And we're looking at water, specifically some of these molecular, very, very specific mechanisms. Can we measure them? And then once we have identified that, can we again cross those individuals with some others that have, for example, better fruit quality or produce more fruit? And we can come up with this super cultivar of cranberries that are not only adapted to climate change, but also produces high yield of high quality. So that is sort of like how we build up a team of solving a problem. In this particular case, is to adapt cranberry cultivars to climate change in Wisconsin.
Amaya Atucha studies the physiology of fruit crops like apples, grapes, and cranberries as an associate professor at the University of Wisconsin-Madison. She's also a fruit crop production specialist in the UW Fruit Program. So where are we then, Amaya, in the process of solving this? Where are we in getting the farmers what they need for the best cranberry crop that Wisconsin can provide?
I wish I could tell you we're going to have a new cultivar right away, but research takes time. And so we are, I think that we're far from developing some of these. I mean, maybe, 5 years from that, but we are in the process of doing it. We already started. And as with every research project, there's always new questions that come up. The more you learn about it, the more questions come up. So there's always side research projects that are coming off of our original idea. So I would say, yes, we will not have a solution right away. If we had maybe the resources that other scientists have to develop things like the COVID-19 vaccine, maybe we could accelerate the process. But the truth is that we have limited resources, and we are only a small little group of researchers working in Wisconsin to try to solve this problem for a very specific industry, which is great. I mean, it's great that we are able to do that because other crops don't even have that possibility. But we're making slow but steady progress into trying to help our cranberry Wisconsin industry.
Well, I am curious now, Amaya, what would you still like to learn about the cranberry?
Oh, there's so many other things. As I was saying, it's true that we have problems during the winter with cold, and that's one that we're addressing, but we also see that we're having problems with heat. One of the problems that other researchers are looking into is how this heat might also affect the development of certain diseases. So working with the plant pathologists or even working with the fruit crop entomologists are looking how these high temperatures during the growing season might also probably affect some of the pests that we might have. That is a very interesting question, just to look at the entire system, not only from the perspective of the plants, but also what happens with the pathogens and also what happens with the insects and how that affects the overall yield.
Amaya Atucha, thank you so much for sharing your work with us.
Oh, my pleasure.
That was UW-Madison Associate Professor Amaya Atucha talking to WPR host Lee Rayburn. They looked at the effects of climate change and the growth of cranberries here in the state. Up next on Central Time, a meteorologist explains the unseasonably high temperatures and dangerous winds ripping across the U.S. from Mexico to Michigan and what to watch for here in Wisconsin. This is Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Verrett. Now, for the second week in a row, a huge swath of the U.S. from New Mexico to Michigan is experiencing unseasonably high temperatures and winds. The National Weather Service called today a historic weather day, referring to a storm system that'll come through and bring winds of up to 70 or 80 miles per hour in some places. We're talking now about potentially dangerous winds and unseasonable warmth here in Wisconsin and in much of the rest of the central U.S. Tim Halbach is the Warning Coordination Meteorologist for the National Weather Service in Milwaukee. Tim, welcome back to Central Time.
Yeah, thanks for having me, Rob.
Well, safety first, Tim. What kind of things should people be thinking about this evening on into the night when it comes to their personal safety and this weather coming?
Well, the main hazard is going to be the winds. It's going to be a little different than some of the thunderstorms that we see over the summer, where you get this brief, like 30-second to 1 minute long burst of winds, we're looking at a pretty prolonged period of high winds. That the main hazard is going to be if any trees or structural damage type things happen because of this prolonged wind. So some of the people that might be a little bit more prone to, you know, being in the elements would be if anybody's out driving around and a tree falls down and they either run their car into it or falls on top of the car, or if you're in the top level of a house and you have trees around, that the winds could potentially blow them down into the top parts of the house. So that's our main concern with this happening overnight. And, you know, everybody's going to be sleeping at that time while these storms come through. So that's our main concern going through tonight.
And we're watching this rip across the country now. Some reports of heavy winds in Colorado and things making their way eastward now. What have we seen so far today?
So far, where the system started in eastern Colorado, it's already gone through all of Nebraska. It's right to the Iowa-Nebraska state line. And they've had 107 mile per hour winds in parts of Colorado down in the southeastern portion of it. Right now, there's a number of tornado warnings going on right along the Missouri River in eastern Nebraska. So a bunch of confirmed tornadoes there and a lot of high winds. So this is going to move further to the northeast and cause some issues for parts of Wisconsin tonight.
Is there a concern about tornado risk here in the state?
The main tornado risk would be up in the northwestern part of the state, where we're kind of watching what's happening right now and trying to translate out how long that's going to take to get into northwestern Wisconsin. And the conditions may not be as prime as what they are right now, but that would be the main area for that concern. And with the conditions we're seeing, it's going to be fast moving storms that could produce some long track tornadoes. But it's one of those forecasts where you hope it doesn't really pan out. But in terms of that potential for tornadoes, it'd be up in mainly the northwestern part of the state.
And Tim, I know sometimes if we hear, okay, probably not tornadoes, just straight line winds, we might not take it as seriously. Those straight line winds can be a serious hazard, right?
Yeah, and that we try not to say, you know, just straight line winds, because it happens over a much larger area. And with this, it's going to be such a prolonged wind and a strong wind that it's going to cause quite a few, damage to trees and all that. The one thing we have going for us right now is that the trees aren't leafed out, so that helps to maybe not create as much drag when the wind is trying to blow through the trees. But regardless, when you're looking at the potential for 60 mile per hour winds for a prolonged period of time, that's going to knock a lot of trees over, or, you know, we're expecting it to, at least.
Talking to Tim Halbach, warning coordination meteorologist for the National Weather Service in Milwaukee, talking about this unusual December weather on the way into the state this evening and overnight, bringing heavy winds. Tim, big picture, what is going on here? This isn't a normal Wisconsin December kind of storm. What's driving this pattern?
Well, it's it is an unusual pattern. Very strong southerly flow that's brought a lot of moisture up from the Gulf of Mexico. Typically something that you'd see, you know, summertime, not typically in the winter, but it's had a big source of warm air from the south that's been pulled up, and the weather system itself is so strong that it can pull all this moisture up into Wisconsin, even when typically it wouldn't get this far north. I was kind of talking with some other folks, kind of reminiscing about January 2008. I happened to be working down in the Chicago area, and we had similar conditions like this where it was so humid and we ended up getting the tornadoes in southeastern Wisconsin that day. But kind of a similar thing where if you can get a lot of strong southerly flow out of the Gulf of Mexico region, you can have this type of weather. The weather doesn't really care what time of year it is. If you get the right conditions, you can get this type of severe weather and strong winds.
And I remember looking at the weather for this week and just seeing, 60 degrees coming up for just one day this week. That'll be nice, but that can be kind of a red flag this time of year, right?
Yeah, you really shouldn't get 60s this time of year. If you are, you know that there's something significant that's potentially happening there to be able to to make that happen. And we're seeing that today in the impacts of, you know, what's going to happen there with the strong winds and the severe weather.
Can you talk about the timeline? When is the advance part of this wind going to be moving through parts of the state from west to east, or I guess southwest to northeast?
Yeah. So what we've been telling people is it's this evening, it's going to be windy, and then it's going to get really, really windy when the line of showers and storms move in. And then we're going to have a long period of prolonged strong winds. And this looks like it'll all start the first really big surge of winds will be entering the western part of the state, maybe around 8 or 9 this evening. And it's going to fly across the state. It's going to basically be through to the eastern part of the state by about midnight tonight. But then after that first wave comes through, if you're watching radar or anything tonight, once you see that move through, we're going to have this prolonged period basically until 6 or 9 o'clock in the morning tomorrow, where we're going to have 30 to 50 mile per hour winds, possibly even still some of these gusts up into the 60 mile per hour range. So long duration, strong winds, and just not a lot of fun.
And what's on the other side of those winds when it comes to temperature here in the state? I'm guessing we're not going to come through this staying at 60.
No, we might break a record for tomorrow if our temperatures are still at this level at midnight tonight. But then by the time you get up tomorrow morning, unless you're awake all night because you can't sleep because of the wind, it'll be dropped down into the 30s pretty quickly by tomorrow morning. So it's not going to be long lasted tomorrow.
Are you looking for people to share information about damage in their community?
Yeah, so you can report to us either through our Facebook or Twitter page, or if you're a storm spotter, you know where to go to be able to report to us. But yeah, any damage that ends up occurring, we don't want people out in the middle of the night searching around for anything. But if you get up in the morning and you see some tree branches down or any kind of damage, we appreciate the report so that we can inform other people that damage did occur.
And you mentioned, of course, with trees coming down, that'll be an issue, and that can lead to power outages. Are there recommendations from the Weather Service on how to prepare for, what to do about those downed lines and power outages?
Yeah, I would keep a flashlight handy that you can, you know, when the power goes out or if the power goes out, you'll be able to, be able to see in your house. If you have to get up in the morning, most people on a Thursday will put batteries in your alarm clock so that when the clock goes out, you're not late for work. And if you feel like if you got a lot of large trees around your house, a safety thing might just be to maybe not sleep on the top level of your house. I know with my family, I think we're going to have a sleepover in the basement tonight just because my kids don't sleep well in the wind anyway. So might as well, play it safe and just be down in the basement for tonight for us.
And just in our last minute, this, of course, comes on the heels of this tragic tornado that killed at least 74 people in Kentucky, also other states. What are we still learning about that very long-lived tornado?
We're still surveying the damage on it because it was such a long tornado. And, it's been a while since we've had something like that. But, we still got a lot of work to do in terms of preparedness and making sure people know what the different type of tornado warnings mean from the Weather Service. There's still work to do to try to help people make, be aware that dangerous tornado is coming their way.
And are we going to see a return? This is two bursts of unseasonable, dramatic weather here in December. Are things going to look more like a normal December just in our last few moments?
Yeah, it looks like we're going to be a little bit closer to normal for being a little bit colder, and then maybe a little bit of warm up right before Christmas, but generally nothing to this level in the 60s or anything like that.
Tim, thanks again for joining us today.
No problem. Thanks for having me.
I've been talking to Tim Halbach, warning coordination meteorologist for the National Weather Service in Milwaukee. He joins us to talk about historic winds and storms making their way through the central United States today, as we heard. On their way into Wisconsin, the beginning of the winds this evening, the worst of it going on overnight as well. Coming up tomorrow on The Morning Show, the head of Wisconsin's Transportation Department joins the program for a look at road, highway, and other transportation spending and what the federal infrastructure bill is going to mean here in Wisconsin. And you, as always, can join in with your thoughts and your questions for the head of the Transportation Department and what you want to see that money go to. That's coming up tomorrow morning at 7 here on the Ideas Network. From Star Wars to Selena to a circus parade from 1902, there are 25 new inductees into the National Film Registry. As reported by NPR, the Library of Congress adds movies to that registry each year to preserve them for the future. The selections are made based on things like cultural impact or historical value and rarity. The newest selection in this week's class was the movie WALL-E from 2008, the oldest rare 1902 footage of a Ringling Brothers circus parade through a black neighborhood in Indianapolis. Other more rare selections include the 1926 movie The Flying Ace, produced by a black film studio in Florida. Some of the biggest names include Star Wars Return of the Jedi and the first movie in the Lord of the Rings trilogy. And of course, there's a 1984 movie with a significant impact on my life, or at least my sleep patterns, A Nightmare on Elm Street. See the full list at npr.org. This is Central Time here on the Ideas Network.